Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film. This is the subscriber-only edition just for you subscribers. So thank you for joining us again and for taking out a subscription. And thanks for being in our gang. I'm Total Film's Editor-in-Chief, Jane Crowther. And in the studio with me today are Deputy Editor Matt Matem.
Hello.
And News Editor Jordan Farley.
Hello.
We'll also be joined a little bit later by our Contributing Editor, Paul Bradshaw. And he'll be telling us all about going on set of Terminator Dark Fate. So coming up, we'll be looking at this week's big releases. And we'll be discussing the biggest films coming out of Toronto's Film Festival. But first, let's get to the episode's special subscriber feature, which is our top 10 time travel movies. So to coincide with Terminator Dark Fate, which obviously employs time travel, we're looking at our top 10. And at number 10, we've got this.
Cooper, what are you doing?
Knocking.
Endurance rotation is 67, 68 RPM.
Okay, get ready to match our spin with the retro thrusters.
It's not possible.
No, it's necessary.
That was Interstellar, Christopher Nolan's timey-wimey effort. Why is that in our top 10, Matt? You're a massive Nolan fan.
I am. I love Nolan's films and I love Interstellar, obviously. And it's one of those films that I almost don't think of as a time travel film immediately, but maybe that's because it takes a slightly more quote-unquote realistic take on time travel, because it's this kind of time dilation effect they have from traveling through these black holes. I'd say for me, it's the most emotional time travel film.
Really? Because that's not something that people have said about Nolan in the past.
No, but I mean, I've argued against that in the past,
yeah.
But I think, yeah, this one especially, I think, is his most kind of outwardly emotional film, perhaps, because just Matthew McConaughey's character, Cooper, obviously where he goes off on this mission, suffers the effects of time dilation and his kids kind of age when he's away. And just the kind of, especially that scene where he gets the video message back from his son, who's kind of played by Timothée Chalamet, then later Casey Affleck, and just him seeing him grow up and see how much he's missed, like, I can't help but get set off during that scene.
Yeah, all that stuff's great, and I love all the relativity stuff, but all the fourth dimensional stuff and him being in the bookcase at the end is a bit shaky.
Sterile.
Yeah.
That's really probably why it's at number 10 in our list. Should we see what's at number 9?
Is that everyone?
What, you wanted more?
Avengers!
Assemble.
That was, of course, no mistaking it, Avengers Endgame, massive film. And obviously the time travel element is key. It's something we discussed a lot when we were waiting for the film to see if that was how things were going to be fixed. Did they do it satisfactorily? What do you think, Jordan?
Yes and no. What I like about the time travel in Endgame is that they deliberately don't take the Back to the Future approach. They go out of their way to say that going back doesn't change things. Time is what it is, basically. But then there's a slightly confusing thing where you take an Infinity Stone out of the timeline and that maybe changes things. So it's a little bit confusing, but I like that they tried a different thing with it, even though it wasn't quite as satisfying as the sort of time travel you know and love from Back to the Future.
But it's still satisfying to see those characters that you sort of had thought you wouldn't see again in those sort of flashbacks to sort of previous encounters.
Yeah, and it sort of plays into the whole fan service element of Endgame, which it kind of did really well, and it really did kind of satisfy fans who had invested all that time into the series. And I think it does what the MCU often does, where it kind of gets away with it because of the humour. So, like, they kind of joke about the time travel, so that kind of allows you to take it with a pinch of salt, even when it, yeah, blatantly doesn't make sense and blatantly twists its own rules. But it's a lot of fun when they do it, so we kind of forgive them.
Okay, let's move on to number 8.
They invade our space and we fall back. They assimilate entire worlds and we fall back. Not again. The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther. I will make them pay for what they've done.
So that's Star Trek First Contact. Jordan, how did this get into the bottom of the list?
Well, it's a great film. The thing that I love about First Contact is obviously it was the first feature film which was led by the Next Generation cast. And it's one of the few sort of Next Generation films. It doesn't just feel like a boring sort of extended episode. It actually justifies the fact that it was a film, because it's a story about first contact with aliens, with Romulans, and the Borg going back and trying to stop them and all that kind of stuff. Like, it doesn't use time travel particularly well. Like, time travel is a fairly small part of it, but the story it tells is really cool, and the Borg are probably the best villains that certainly the Next Generation Star Trek ever had. And it did give us Zefram Cochran, which is possibly the greatest character name of all time.
Yes. And you don't want to say that incorrectly, do you?
Exactly.
And do you think it works if you haven't watched the Next Generation TV series?
Yeah, it does. It's one of the few that does, actually. There isn't a ton of like character development, so if you don't know the characters particularly well, you might not entirely get a great deal from their sort of minute arcs over the course of the film. But for the most part, it does sort of stand alone and work.
Let's move on to what's at number 7.
God isn't interested in technology. He knows nothing of the potential of the microchip or the Silicon Revolution. Look how he spends his time. 43 species of parrots. Nipples for men. Slugs. Slugs! He created slugs. They can't hear, they can't speak, they can't operate machinery. I mean, are we not in the hands of a lunatic?
And that was Time Bandits, which is quite different from the other films we've discussed before. Do you like this one, Jordan? Is this something that you hold close to your heart?
Yeah, I love Time Bandits. I love Terry Gilliam's trilogy of imagination, as he called it, which, continued with Brazil and Baron Munchausen. And arguably this one's sort of the most imaginative of the three, because it's sort of seen through the eyes of a young boy. But the really fun part of Time Bandits for me is all these cameos by, very accomplished, usually British thesps, like Ian Holm as Napoleon and Sean Connery as Agamemnon and John Cleese is in there as Robin Hood. Like, all that stuff is just so much fun.
It does feel a bit Monty Python, doesn't it? It throws back to that. So if you have a fondness for that, it's something that would tickle your funny bone. Okay, let's look at what makes it in at number 6.
I mean, who cares if Ling Ling returns the wallet and keeps the money? Has nothing to do with either fear or love.
Fear and love are the deepest of human emotions.
Okay, but you're not listening to me. There are other things that need to be taken into account here, like the whole spectrum of human emotion. You can't just lump everything into these two categories and then just deny everything else.
And that is, of course, Donnie Darko, which is a film I have to admit I don't love. And
shock horror.
I know. It's one that everybody holds in high regard, and it just left me cold. Why do you love it so much, boys?
Well, I had an interesting experience with Donnie Darko in the sense that I was similar to you when I first saw it, but then for some reason I felt like I needed to revisit it. This was quite soon after it had come out, and then on the second viewing it just really, everything just clicked into place for me, and I suddenly was like, sort of saw everything that I missed the first time, and just it all just really worked. And I don't know what it is that I particularly love about it, but I think it was just, I was the right age when I saw it, and Jake Gyllenhaal was just so cool in it, and it kind of really marked his arrival as a star, and just the way it kind of reinvented people like Patrick Swayze as well. It was just, it felt like someone with a really fresh kind of vision and a really new take.
Yeah, I agree. And there are a couple of things I really love about it. The first being that it's such an enigmatic and mysterious film. It's one of those films where you really have to piece it together, like especially the theatrical cut, not the director's cut, which goes a bit overboard explaining stuff. You really have to watch it and kind of consider it after to actually work out what the hell's even going on in it. Like, I remember the first time I watched it, I just had no idea what I'd just watched, and retreated to some like ancient message board, like some MSN message boards, to find out what it was even about. But in terms of its time travel, I really love the fact that it's sort of a closed loop movie. Like, I love that stuff where, like the first scene is basically the same as the last scene, and you realize that this whole story is just a closed circle now. Like, I think that's just a really clever structure for time travel stories that not enough people do.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that is 10-6, so let's look at 5-1 next podcast and see what made the top of the list. But for now, let's talk news. So last week, Matt and I were at Toronto Film Festival, where we were running between screenings and interviewing various film stars and directors and trying to find out what the big hitters are that will be coming out for awards season. Toronto is traditionally the place that the awards fight begins, and the runners and riders do seem to come out of that festival. So, Matt, who was looking good for possible awards coming out of Toronto this year?
Well, one of the big indicators that you get at Toronto, or TIFF as we kind of call it for short when you're there, is they have this thing, the People's Choice Awards, where audiences vote on films they love, and that's often seen as a big indicator for a film that has a good chance at Best Picture, like Green Book won it last year. And just over the past 10 years, there's been many films that have gone on to do well at the Oscars after that. And this year, Jojo Rabbit won the People's Choice Award.
Which was a bit of a surprise,
yeah,
wasn't it?
And I actually didn't see it. It got slightly mixed reviews. But yeah, that's Taika Waititi's kind of anti-Nazi satire. And yeah, so that's kind of instantly given it a spot in the running for Best Picture, we think. So expect to see that kind of popping up a lot in the nominations as we kind of head towards the Oscars.
Yeah, and another one that we saw that I saw was A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which is Tom Hanks in a sort of very teary ode to Mr. Rogers, a US sort of TV show host for children's telly. He's not somebody that we know that well in the UK, but the film is truly sort of heartrending, and probably Hanks is in the picture again for another awards nomination there. Who else do you reckon will go up against him?
Adam Driver's an interesting one, because he's great in two films that are coming out, and both kind of had outings at TIFF, which are The Report and Marriage Story. But sometimes people, when they have kind of two great roles, they can cancel themselves out almost and split their vote and then not end up getting nominated. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that, and if there's one that's favoured that, you know, he will actually kind of push on with, that will be seen as his kind of ticket to the awards. Perhaps Marriage Story, because that was the runner-up for the People's Choice, which again kind of puts it in a good position going
forward. And that's Driver and Scarlett Johansson in a story about a couple sort of dissolving their marriage, and the thing that brought them together and the thing that pulls them apart. It's an amazing film, and both of them are excellent. So she might very well get a nod as well for that.
She could do, and she's also in Jojo Rabbit as well. So she's going to be busy this award season.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ladies. Obviously, Renée Zellweger was there with Judy, which is a pretty amazing performance. The film, we don't love the film so much, but her performance is certainly going to sort of get Oscar and other awards sort of spotlight, isn't it?
Yeah. I think you could sort of describe it as a 5-star performance in a 3-star film, but she really does lift it, and she really is great. And I enjoyed the film overall. I don't think the film kind of holds her back particularly, but it is really a kind of showcase for her and her performance. And I'd say, yeah, she has to be the real front runner at the moment.
But let's not forget about J-Lo. There's a lot of talk about J-Lo for Hustlers, possibly getting an Oscar nod. As sort of ridiculous as that sounds, it's not beyond the realms of possibility, right?
I don't think it is at all, really, because I think Hustlers has been so well received. It's almost like it felt like time for her to have a comeback, really. And she is so good in it. It's one of those roles that's kind of perfect for her. And I think she's probably likely to be in supporting actress contention, I think, for this, which I think also could help her chances if she's not up against Renée Zellweger. So I think she's definitely one to kind of watch out for on the circuit as well.
Another unlikely person that people were talking about at TIFF was Adam Sandler possibly getting a nod for Uncut Gems, where he plays this sort of obnoxious, loud jewellery dealer in New York who's just unravelling throughout the film. Do you think he could possibly get a nod? I mean, let's also face it that all of these guys are going up against Joaquin Phoenix in The Joker, which I think is a done deal that he's going to be on any sort of roster.
Well, I didn't see Uncut Gems, so I'm going to have to defer to you on that. But I know Adam Sandler, again, it feels like he's been due a good role, because he's been in these slightly naff comedies for a while. So I think it's nice to actually see him stretching himself a bit. But And I'm kind of desperate to see the film, but what did you think of it? How do you rate his chances after having seen it?
I mean, it's a completely fearless performance. He's dislikable throughout, and that's quite interesting to see him play that. He's not trying to play sort of this schlubby nice guy that he often does in the comedies. It's sort of gritty and darkly funny and horrific at some points. So who knows, maybe we would have like a Adam Sandler J-Lo double header at the Oscars this year. Who knows? Let's also look at the other films that we sort of enjoyed at the festival. What were your top three takeaways from the festival this year?
My top three films that I saw at the festival this year, not in any particular order, but I loved Sound of Metal, which was starred Riz Ahmed, and it's the directorial debut of Darius Marder. And it sounds quite pat when you sort of sum it up in a line, but it's basically about a kind of punk rock drummer who starts losing his hearing. And then it sort of follows his story from there. It's a low key sort of indie drama, but it's just so kind of, so immersive because largely down to the sound design, where you're often kind of hearing what he's hearing and you're getting all that distortion. But yeah, Riz is just great in it as well. And it's just, yeah, it's one of those films that really sort of blindsided me, where you kind of, as you often do at festivals, you go in not really expecting much from a film or not knowing much about it. And yeah, it completely took me by surprise. So I love that. I also love Knives Out, which is Rian Johnson's murder mystery movie. It's kind of very, very much in the Agatha Christie mold, but set in the modern day, but with all those kind of old trappings you expect. It's all set within this big old mansion. There's this kind of extended family that are all gathered. There's a mystery to be solved. And there's a detective played by Daniel Craig, and he's called Benoit Blanc, which just is like a classic. It feels like it's come out of one of those books. It feels like it shouldn't have been invented just
now. And he's doing an accent, isn't he?
And he's doing a sort of Foghorn Leghorn type accent, but he has so much fun in it. And I really, yeah, really enjoyed his performance. Obviously, he's very serious as Bond, and for some people too serious. But yeah, he has a lot of fun in this, and it was really nice to kind of see him in that kind of role. So that's definitely one to keep your eyes open for. And the last one that I'll highlight is Honey Boy, which is written by Shia LaBeouf, and he co-stars in it as well. So the film follows this child actor on these two timelines, and the younger version is played by Noah Jupe from A Quiet Place, and the older version is played by Lucas Hedges, who you might have seen in Boy Erased. In the older timeline, he's kind of coming to terms with his past and his youth, and he's in a rehab facility kind of and in therapy. And then you kind of flash back to his childhood, where he's played by Noah Jupe, and he's with his father, who Shia LaBeouf actually plays. And you kind of just see this weird life he lives and the sort of weird experiences that go into eventually sort of sending him off the rails, I suppose. But it's really, I found it really, really affecting and really moving. And it's also, it's just a fantastic performance for Shia LaBeouf. So if we sort of throw back to the Oscars thing, I wouldn't be surprised to see him in sort of supporting actor and screenplay nominations, possibly.
Let's see. My three, I also loved Honey Boy, but I had a sort of surprise one from Calm with Horses, which is an Irish film about a sort of ex-boxer who has now become a sort of henchman for a local gang and is sort of trying to get out of that life and also look after his autistic son. And it's beautifully filmed. It's gritty. It's terrifying. I chewed all my nails off watching it. It's really stylistically done. You know, the sound design is amazing in it. And it's a new director called Nick Rowland, who was a film student a few years ago. And he's now made this amazing film. It got really great reviews. I also enjoyed Marriage Story, which we discussed previously with ScarJo and Adam Driver. Really, really good. Heartbreaking to watch. And Just Mercy was getting a lot of attention, and it's worth seeing that one, which is the story of a man incarcerated who may or not have committed the crime, but he's on death row, and Michael B. Jordan's lawyer is trying to get him off. That's based on a true story. It also stars Brie Larson, and it is a total tear fest. So classy, so good. I expect to see that in the Oscars as well. So just to recap, our Best Actor Awards frontrunners coming out of TIFF, we reckon, are Tom Hanks, Adam Sandler, Joaquin Phoenix, Michael B. Jordan, and Adam Driver. And our Best Actress Award frontrunners, Renée Zellweger, J-Lo, and possibly ScarJo for Marriage Story. But we'll see as we go along with more festivals where they end up. Okay, time now to focus upon this week's big releases, starting with this.
Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system. All life could be destroyed. We're counting on you to find out what's happening.
I love you. I worry about you.
Are you truly sure that you're ready to go on this voyage?
I'm ready.
That was, of course, Ad Astra, which is out on the 18th of September. What is this about, Jordan?
So Ad Astra, set in the near-ish future, stars Brad Pitt as astronaut Roy McBride. Right at the start of the film, we learn that cosmic rays coming from Neptune are causing power surges sort of around the globe with potentially cataclysmic consequences. But the government's sort of convinced that there's nothing natural about these cosmic rays. In fact, they believe that Roy's father, Clifford, played by Tommy Lee Jones, which is great casting, is behind them. Because Clifford was also an astronaut, this legendary astronaut who headed up the LEMA project, a mission to Neptune to seek life in the universe. And the powers that be believe that Roy is their only hope of getting through to Cliff. So they send Roy on a mission to Mars, not to invoke that notorious Brian De Palma misfire, in order to send a message to his father and hopefully sort of talk him down from whatever's going on. This is really, really great. We gave this 5 stars, and spoiler alert, you're going to see that it's going to land very high on our current top 10
yep.
list. Our updated year list. The comparison that everyone's made, including myself on Twitter, is that James Gray, the director and co-writer of this film, has essentially made Apocalypse Now in space with this. So Brad Pitt is basically playing Martin Sheen's Willard, mm-hmm. and Tommy Lee Jones is Kurtz at the heart of darkness in the middle of space. The thrust of the story is very sort of streamlined and propulsive. Roy essentially has to get from A to B, A being Earth, B being Neptune, which involves, it's not like he's jumping on like an X-Wing and going at light speed and getting there in 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's a very grounded sort of realistic approach to space travel. Like it starts with him getting on like a Virgin Atlantic's like consumer rocket to the moon. And he has to pay like $125 for a pillow and a blanket because he wants to sleep. Because this is really like a very sort of grounded depiction of space travel. It has this lovely sort of tactile used future aesthetic of something like Alien or yeah. Star Wars. And the sort of austere, bold cinematography of 2001. But it should be said that it's not all sort of sitting in passenger seats and going through customs, which
there's
a bit of that.
A car race, a moon buggy race.
Exactly, yeah. There's some really impressive action sequences, like that moon sort of sequence. He has to get from one side of the moon to the other, and he's in this moon buggy, and he's sort of attacked by these space pirates that live on the moon, because there's these lovely sort of background details throughout the film where you find out, like, people from other countries, so there's sort of a war going on the moon for territory up there, so they like attack anyone who's in sort of this no man's land on the moon. So you get this amazing sort of Fury Road in zero G kind of car race where they're like shooting each other and tires are blowing out and cars are spinning off but kind of floating because there's no gravity. And it's really sort of beautiful and chaotic at the same time. And one of the things I really liked about it actually is it has a, even though it's very serious, very realistic take on space travel, it has this sort of pulp sensibility as well, where there's very bizarre and unexpected things that happen. Like, there's nothing, you know, ridiculous. I mean, there are ridiculous things, but just, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil
it.
Fun moments where I was like, I was not expecting that from this film,
yeah.
which I really appreciate.
It's not as po-faced as perhaps the trailer suggests.
No, definitely not.
It has a sense of humour.
It has some moments where it will, tickle you and thrill you, definitely. So it's beautifully made, but it also has substance to back up its style. It's a film that's essentially about Roy coming to terms with the fact that his father sort of abandoned him as a child to go off into space on this mission.
And it's probably an Oscar nod for Brad.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Brad Pitt's really fantastic in this film. Obviously, he's one of the greats of his generation. You know, he's not a Daniel Day-Lewis, like he's not like a method actor or anything, but he is obviously a great screen presence. But in this, he really does have way more emotional sort of depth and subtlety than I think I've ever seen him have on screen before. And I'm sure you can credit a certain amount of that to James Gray, who always seems to get great performances out of his actors. But I'd argue that Pitt's sort of never been better than he is here.
Wow.
Like, he's playing a real sort of character rather than what feels like himself just being really cool and laid back like he was in, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Ocean's 11 and Fight Club and all that. So yeah, this is a really sort of special film and one you should seek out in the cinema.
Yeah, see it on the big screen.
Exactly. It deserves it.
Okay, let's look at this week's hidden gem. And that is The Farewell, which is a sort of heart-rending story of a young woman trying not to let her grandma know that she's terminally ill. That doesn't sound like a laugh a minute or something that you would really want to go and see. But is it?
Well, yeah, you really should go and see it. I mean, I just said that Ad Astra is a really special film, and this is another really special film. So this is Lulu Wang's semi-autobiographical account of a very peculiar event in her life. Awkwafina, who you may recognize from Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8, plays Billy, who's loosely based on Lulu Wang. Billy's Chinese-American, but has lived in America most of her life. She's moved out of her parents, but is having a hard time of it and just got rejected from art school and things like that. And her one beacon of light in her life is the fact that she has sort of regular phone calls with her grandma, who she calls Nai Nai, and she's referred to sort of Nai Nai throughout the film. She finds out one day that Nai Nai has been diagnosed with a terminal disease, cancer, and has a matter of months, if not weeks, to live. But rather than tell Nai Nai, Billy's family keep Nai Nai's illness a secret from her so that Nai Nai can live out her remaining time in a sort of blissful ignorance, and they can kind of shoulder the burden of the pain of the fact that she's going to die. And so to compound the ridiculousness of this situation, they arrange a fake sort of shotgun wedding for one of Billy's cousins to give the entire family an excuse to visit their grandmother, their matriarch, and essentially say goodbye without Nai Nai getting suspicious, without her knowing. And it sounds like the setup for a slapstick farce, like something in different hands that would just be completely farcical and stupid. But obviously this is based on a real event in Lulu Wang's life and is actually, as far as I'm aware, a fairly common occurrence in China, because the idea that the family will shoulder the painful burden of a loved one's terminal illness is just an intrinsic part of their culture around death. It's shot very matter of fact. It's very sort of unadorned, in real apartments around the real region of China that Lulu Wang's family is from. And that sort of authenticity is key to why it's sort of so compelling and believable and
moving.
Real. Exactly. Yeah. Really just heartfelt. And the heart of Billy's sort of conflict in particular is really compelling. Because she was raised in America, she's really struggling with the idea that the fact that someone she loves is dying is being kept a secret from her. She doesn't think this is necessarily the right thing to do. But the film isn't judging the characters either way. Like, it's not saying that it's wrong to do this. It's trying to come to an understanding of both sides, rather than condemning either point of view. Awkwafina's really quite remarkable here.
I mean, this is her doing dramatic, which we haven't seen her do before.
Yeah, I mean, if you've seen her in Crazy Rich Asians, you know she can be sort of larger than life and just crazy. But here she's very sort of sullen, like she walks in a kind of hunched way, and she's just very, like, it's all sort of internalized and it's all just on her face. Yeah, she's fantastic, and it's a real sort of statement for what she's capable of as an actor, and I'm sure we'll see her in more dramatic roles going forward. But really what I loved about this is that even though it's a very intimate, small story, it does take really big emotional swings, but it never feels sentimental or soppy. It always just feels real and grounded and believable, and it feels like it comes from an honest place.
Yeah, and it's also just really refreshing to see, you know, something, look at a different culture that and see different faces on the screen and just to actually see that representation there.
Yeah, one of the really admirable things about the film is that Lulu Wang's been trying to make this film for years, but she couldn't get it financed. No one wanted to finance the film that she wanted to make. So she actually made it as a radio play. Well, she told her story on This American Life, the famous podcast, and that got the attention of a producer, Chris Weitz, who is obviously a director as well, and that allowed her to make the film the way she wanted to, actually in China, using authentic language. Like 70%, I think, of this film is subtitled because it's all in authentic language. And I think if you'd have made this film the way that I actually spoke to Lulu Wang for the magazine a couple of months ago, and she was saying how she would have studios come up to her and say, oh, we'll make this, but you have to make the center of the story, Billy takes a fake fiance to China, and her fake fiance is a white guy, and it's a kind of culture clash, or will they, won't they get together despite their cultural differences kind of thing. If it had been that, it would have been horrible.
Yeah.
But the fact that it feels so truthful and it comes from such an honest place is what really makes this so effective.
So everyone go and see that one. That's a hidden gem for this week. It's The Farewell. Also at cinemas and streaming at home is Hotel Mumbai, which is what, Matt?
This is a kind of recreation of a real terrorist incident that took place in Mumbai when a giant hotel was held hostage, basically. And it's one of those films that has a slight United 93 vibe about it, where it's just very much throws you into this experience. And it's very well done, I would argue, but it's adds up to quite an unpleasant experience because it's so unrelentingly horrific that I kind of almost, I find it a hard film to recommend because I don't know when you're ever going to want to actually go to the cinema and experience such a horrible kind of series of events that feels so kind of claustrophobic.
Well, yeah, I sort of found it difficult to know what the point of it was. I mean, it's very well done. It shows the sort of humanity of the people who were trapped there, and it shows people helped each other out, and there were heroes, everyday heroes, with, you know, the chef and the porter and the waiter and at the hotel sort of risked their lives and everything. But as you say, it is so relentlessly bleak, and as it should be because it's recounting real events, that you sort of don't really know what the takeaway is, because you already know about this in from the news. So it's one of those ones that's you would not go for entertainment.
No, and it's because it's a Sky Cinema release. It's coming out at the cinema and on home entertainment at pretty much the same time. So maybe it's a better one to kind of check out at home, because it's a very full-on experience in the cinema, and there's kind of no escaping it. So, yeah, depending on how brave you're feeling, you know, maybe you opt to watch it at home.
So those release dates, Ad Astra is out on the 18th of September, The Farewell on the 20th, and Hotel Mumbai is at cinemas and at Sky Cinema on the 27th of September. So quickly, let's round up. What are our personal awards for this week? Jordan.
So my award is for the most appetizing film of the week, which I'm awarding to The Farewell, which has many, many scenes set around a dinner table where they're eating lots of delicious looking food.
So you need to have a full stomach before you watch that film.
Exactly right. Or you need a table booked at a very good restaurant afterwards.
Okay, Matt.
And mine's also food related, but it's related to the Toronto Film Festival, where they literally sell the best ice creams ever at this place called Sweet Jesus. And it's the perfect spot between the kind of press room and where the main cinema is, where you have the screenings. There's this ice cream place called Sweet Jesus, which just, I can't even really explain it. Just the toppings and stuff they do. It's like what you need to basically keep you going during a festival, just popping in there. So yeah, that's my award, best ice cream at a festival.
My award is for the best pole dancing scene ever committed to film, and that would be for Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers. I mean, seriously, this woman, it's amazing to see what she can do with a pole. And I don't think anyone's ever worn Diamante better. So man, woman, you know, mineral, animal, whatever, you're going to appreciate that scene. So well done, J-Lo. Okay, let's move on to this month's cover feature, which is Terminator Dark Fate.
My name is Sarah Connor. August 29, 1997. It was supposed to be Judgment Day. But I changed the future. I've never seen one like you before. Almost human.
I am human. Just enhanced. Why do you care what happens to her?
Because I was her.
Sarah!
I can see you're very upset.
I'll be back.
Our contributing editor, Paul Bradshaw, was on set of this return to the Terminator world, and he's popped in to tell us all about meeting Arnie. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
How was it on set? Where did you go, first of all, to watch this?
I went to Budapest. It was in the Arrigo Studios, just outside of Budapest, and it was a very surreal experience. It was not really like any other set visit I've been on. Usually when you turn up, you kind of walk past all the kind of people eating their sandwiches and trip over all the wires and see all the kind of behind-the-curtain stuff. For me, my first introduction to walking on the set was opening the wrong door and meeting Arnold Schwarzenegger in a leather jacket, carrying a shotgun, glowering at me behind a door that I'd walked through the wrong one somehow.
Wow. Were you in trouble for doing that?
I probably walked into his private toilet or something, I don't know. But no, it's fine. But then it got more surreal as it went on, because we then went to see a scene which was inside a gigantic soundstage with a very big sort of factory they'd built. There were all these red lights flashing and smoke everywhere. And again, Arnie walked through a door followed by Linda Hamilton dressed as Sarah Connor. And it felt like being in one of those kind of universal theme park rides. It didn't feel like I was on a movie set. It felt like I was in the film I'd watched. It felt like being in Terminator 2 when I was a kid again, which was pretty amazing.
And what were they like to talk to?
They were really good. Linda particularly was a real character. She's an interesting lady. She she spoke very kind of candidly about being worried about wanting to come back to Terminator, because she's obviously avoided it for quite a long time. But she spoke about it a lot. She sounded like she did it all for the right reasons. And to be honest, everybody on set, they talked like they were there for the right reasons, which is kind of encouraging, because we know we've been burnt before by other Terminator sequels. And everybody we spoke to talked about not really liking those films, including the director, Tim Miller.
Right.
And it sounded like he kind of wanted to brush those aside. We know that this one obviously is ignoring those films in the timeline, and it's jumping right back to Terminator 2. And everyone was a big fan of that film and wanted to make this film to feel like this one was picking up where that film left off back in 1991.
You're a big fan of the Terminator franchise, aren't you, Jordan?
Yeah.
Does this excite you, this idea that we're going back and that we're sort of skipping over the kind of rubbish ones?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it feels like a bit of a retcon. Like, I seem to remember James Cameron sort of bigging up Terminator Genesis a few years ago, but he is fully on board with this one, which reassures me greatly, because I think he's a genius and one of the greatest filmmakers ever. So the fact that he's been involved from the start, has a story credit on it, that encourages me greatly. Yeah, definitely.
And most importantly, Paul, what did you have from Craft Services for your lunch?
I had a vegetarian wrap, and it was really good. Yeah, I've had really terrible food in Budapest before because they seem to hate vegetarians there, but this was good.
Good. So down to Arnie that you got good vegetarian food.
Yeah, I thanked him. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks very much. We will talk to you another time. But now let's move on to Total Film's Top 10. So this is our top 10 of the year. By the end of the year, it will have a conclusive top 10, but in between now and then, it moves up and down as new films come in and drop out. So at number 10, If Beale Street Could Talk. This has gone down the list, but it's still hanging on there. Number 9, Vox Lux, also going down. Could this be gone from the list by the end of the year? At number 8, a new entry with The Farewell. We talked about this earlier. It's an absolute corker. At number 7, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's going down the list, but it's still staying in there. At number 6, The Souvenir, also going down the list. At number 5, Avengers Endgame, still staying in there. At number 4, Booksmart. At number 3, Eighth Grade. And at number 2, a new entry with Ad Astra. This is Apocalypse Now in Space, according to Jordan, and it's James Gray's interstellar sci-fi featuring a rarely better Brad Pitt. And in at number 1, Todd Phillips's comic book character study, Joker, which daringly updates the Joker for our troubled times with an Oscar-worthy performance from Joaquin Phoenix. Obviously, Joker isn't out for a few weeks, but you can read our 5-star review in the current issue of Total Film. So, will those films still be there by the end of the year, or will the glut of awards botherers knock them out? Let's see. Stay with us in print and on pod to find out. Okay, and now let's move on to our nostalgia section, where in our buff section of the magazine, we have a feature called Is It Just Me?, where somebody argues a point of view that may not be everyone's opinion. So this week, is the DVD market not really dead? Do we agree with Anton van Beek, or is the DVD market actually thriving? What do we think? I mean, people keep telling us this format's dying, it's dead, it's on its way out. Is it actually thriving? What do you think?
I guess I'll sum up Anton's point of view in the piece in the magazine for our Is It Just Me section. He sort of argues that the DVD market isn't dead because of these sort of boutique labels like Arrow and the Criterion Collection, who are sort of thriving by releasing beloved films with, you know, bespoke cover art and all new features and all that kind of stuff, rather than, you know, the traditional to slap a film on a disc and expect people to buy millions of copies of it market, which is sort of gradually declining, I think it's fair to say, like due to the rise of streaming and things like that. Yeah, I guess I sort of agree with him. I buy very little on disc nowadays, it has to be said. I used to be a really avid DVD buyer in the DVD heyday. Like, I still have a collection of about 2,000 DVDs or something ridiculous.
But why don't you want to buy them anymore? Is it because of streaming? Because it's easier just to watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, number one, streaming, much easier. Number two, I just don't have the storage space for that many discs and boxes and plastic cases and cardboard cases around my house.
But it's really nice to have them. Don't you think it's really nice to have something tangible, to see them up there, to have those nice boxes, the steel boxes, the things that have, you know, the discs are like shaped like records or whatever it is. It's nice to have that, and it makes it more special to own it, don't you think?
For me, there's like a kind of handful of films every year that I love that I'll buy. If it's a kind of director I'm particularly fond of, or if it's just a film I absolutely love that I think will just, you know, look exceptionally good on Blu-ray. But they have to be films that I really do know I'll revisit, because I, similarly like Jordan, in the kind of DVD heyday, I just had so many, my shelves were just kind of heaving with them. And then so often I'd kind of come to get them out and they'd still be in their plastic wrap and I'd realise I'd never actually watched them. And I think, especially because streaming services just open up so many films to you, you just have such variety you can kind of dip into on there, that to actually then find time to kind of get your DVDs out, I find I just not really doing it as much anymore. So for me now, it really has to be those essential ones that I know I'm going to kind of watch time and time again for me to actually kind of buy a hard copy.
Do you think we're going to reach a stage though where we don't have DVDs for sale and Blu-rays because it's just not worth producing them?
Possibly, which is a horrifying prospect, because the thing that the streaming service at the moment do particularly poorly is having sort of library titles and classic films on there. I mean, especially Netflix in the UK, which is pretty terrible for anything made before like 2000. Like, yeah. You don't get anything on there basically. So it's really essential that there's a place you can go and get these films and actually watch them.
Yeah, we need that service, don't we?
I think as well, kind of to tie it back to Anton's point as well, I think that with the DVD market, they are just, I think we're just going to see ever more kind of premium packs for DVDs where you'll get kind of booklets with them and just, you know, ridiculous special features, as we're kind of seeing with certain like Criterion releases. And
well, they're collector's items, things. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, and just, yeah, to make it feel like it's sort of worth investing in, to make it feel more worth having it in that physical version where it's going to have like, yeah, special covers with special kind of foil treatments or like steel books and all that kind of thing. I think, yeah, we'll, if anything, we'll just see it go even more extreme and perhaps it will become like the film equivalent of vinyl.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where,
yeah,
you'll get those collectors still and you'll get special shops where you can go and get them, but there'll be special titles. It won't just be every single film.
So I think we can agree that it's not just Anton. The DVD market is not really dead, but it's not looking well.
Yeah, I think for beloved films that people want to own, there's always going to be a market for that. But, you know, for Bruce Willis's latest straight-to-video action movie, maybe there won't be a DVD market for that anymore.
Perhaps it's best you can't buy that. So join us next podcast when we'll be discussing star ratings and how we've got it wrong, how we've got it right, and how it's tricky to determine a high 3 from a 4-star. But that's all we've got time for now. So please join us next time when we'll be looking forward to the London Film Festival and some more new releases. Do come back. And you can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram to keep up to date with all the stuff we get into the office. There's a lot of cakes. So it's goodbye from Matt and Jordan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next time. Bye.